third case for oral argument this morning is Yale Bank Insurance Company Appellant versus North Star Mutual Insurance Company Appellee, and also Brad Peterson et al. Appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Robert Anderson, attorney from Tier, and for the appellee, North Star, we have Mr. Michael Schaefer, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees Petersons, we have Mr. Rodney Freeman, an attorney from Huron. Now, Mr. Schaefer, I understand you'll be going first and speaking for 5 minutes, and then Mr. Freeman for 15, is that correct? Okay. Mr. Anderson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Police the court, my name is Rob Anderson, and I'm here for the appellant Milbank Insurance Company. This appeal arises from an incident where Mitch Peterson, then a minor, was injured in a shooting accident on November 24th, 2001. At the time, he was a backseat passenger in a pickup owned by his uncle Brad. The pickup was not moving. It was parked in front of their house waiting for somebody to come out and join them. The gun that discharged and caused the bullet to strike him fired when his cousin Jeb, also a backseat passenger, repositioned the gun in the back seat. This action was initially brought by North Star seeking to enforce an exclusion in their farm liability policy issued to Peterson Brothers Farms. North Star alleged that although there was coverage under their policy, an exclusion should be enforced to exclude this claim from that coverage. The circuit court ultimately agreed. Milbank, by cross-claim and counterclaim, contested and denied the fact that there was any coverage granted for this particular incident because the insuring clause in the Milbank policy did not provide coverage. As I mentioned, the circuit court found that North Star's exclusion was effective, found that Milbank's insuring clause did, in fact, provide coverage for this incident. Milbank appealed the circuit court decision as to Milbank's coverage. Milbank did not appeal the circuit court's decision finding the North Star exclusion to be enforceable, so I'm not here contending the circuit court should have done anything different than it did in regard to North Star. The issue here is whether the incident where Mr. Peterson was injured was an, quote, auto accident, as the Milbank policy uses that term. The key provision of the Milbank policy here is the insuring agreement, or the insuring clause, which reads, we will pay damages for bodily injury or property damage for which any insured becomes legally responsible because of an auto accident. The term auto accident is not defined in the policy. This court has many times...
How does the policy define insured?
You or any member of your household using the vehicle, I'm paraphrasing, because I don't think it's an issue here, but I would say it would be a typical definition of insured.
Okay, but it does include the word use of the vehicle in the insured definition.
Who's using the vehicle?
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the other person in the back seat of the car was one of the insureds?
He was a member of one of the insured's families. The insured was made up of a partnership of three Peterson families. And Brad, who owned the pickup, was one of the Peterson brothers. Jeb was his son in the back seat that moved the gun when it discharged. He was a cousin of Mitch who was shot. And there was another Peterson boy sitting in the front seat at the time this happened.
Did you say that there was no definition of bodily injury in the policy?
No, bodily injury is defined. There's
okay.
No question there was bodily injury.
What was
injury.
The term you said that wasn't defined?
Auto accident.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Does that weaken your argument as your company wrote the policy and could have defined it any way it wanted to?
Well, I think this is a good place to look at why you have any. The answer is most decisions are going to say yes. If it's not defined, then the court has a little more latitude in defining it itself. But it's typical in terms of insuring clauses that terms utilized in insuring clauses are not defined. Now, this is a relatively new definition in terms of conditioning coverage on the occurrence of an auto accident. Most of the cases this court has decided in the past in similar circumstances involved, I'd say, an older type of insuring clause that provided coverage for ownership, maintenance, use, loading, or unloading of a motor vehicle. Also, none of those terms were motor vehicle would be defined, but the other terms would not customarily be defined. So the court would oftentimes have to define those.
Is this a standard, whatever you call it,
policy? An ISO policy?
Mm-hmm.
This definition is a fairly new definition, and it's a case of first impression with this court, as far as I can tell, and the learned counsel on the other side haven't told me any different, and I'm sure they would have found out had it not been the case. So the answer is it may be standard now, but it hasn't been in use for very long. That's correct.
Mr. Anderson, before you get to the legal arguments, I want to ask you a couple of questions about the findings of the trial court.
Right, I want to discuss those, yes.
Because it may end up driving the outcome in this case. And my question involves, the trial court found both a hunting expedition and a loading or unloading. And it seems to me like there was plenty of evidence this could have been found to be a hunting expedition. But I'm a little bit unclear as to what the trial court was thinking of when he found that this was a loading or unloading of a vehicle. What's your observation of those
two? Okay, I wanted to talk about the facts because I think even though this is a case of first impression defining terms and looking at a legal decision made by the circuit court, it is driven by the facts. And there were, in particular, three findings of fact that the circuit court made, which I believe are clearly erroneous and not supported by anything on the record. Their finding of fact 56, which finds that the accident occurred in connection with the use of a vehicle and during the loading or unloading. Finding 57, which finds that there was a causal connection between the use of the vehicle and the injury. And finding 58, which finds that the efficient and predominating cause of the accident arose from the use of the vehicle. Then we have the finding about the hunting expedition. Well, they'd been hunting the day before. Those facts are undisputed. They were hunting that morning. I think their plan was to go hunting that afternoon. They weren't hunting when this happened. But I don't think the fact that they had been engaged in hunting previously or had plans to do so in the future is very significant. But I do think it's significant that the findings, and these findings were proposed by the appellees to deal with, I think, some very problematic decisions that don't support their position in this case. There isn't any evidence, in my opinion, that this occurred during the loading or unloading. Here's what happened. The pickup was parked in front of the Peterson house. The rifle which discharged had been placed in the pickup the preceding evening or late afternoon, had never been moved since. It had never been taken from the pickup since, remained in the pickup. They had gone home that noon, eat, get change clothes, get dressed, warm up, and they were going back out. They got into the pickup. All four of the occupants that were in the pickup at the time the gun discharged were in the pickup for several minutes, according to the findings, and that's undisputed. The pickup was running, but it wasn't moving and had not moved. And they were waiting for another one of the Peterson kids to come out and join them. And what happened was the gun, according to Jeb, that the barrel was pointing more towards the other occupant, Mitch, and he wanted to move it so it didn't present a dangerous situation. And that's when it went off. I think if you look at all the cases, including the one South Dakota case that discusses, at least in passing, what happens when you move a gun inside a vehicle, and that's the Lindo versus American Standard case. This is a case where people were not loading or unloading the gun, not putting it into the vehicle, taking it out, not putting it into a gun rack or taking it out, not loading shells into it and moving it around. They were repositioning or handling the gun inside the vehicle.
Where did the trial court come up with that finding?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, it was a finding proposed by the appellees, and it was adopted by the court.
Does it really matter, though? I mean, in his opinion, whether it was loading or unloading? Isn't really the issue here whether that was the situs, as we talked about in Lindo?
Yeah, I think if it was merely the site, merely a location for the accident to happen, this wasn't an auto accident, then there would be no coverage. I think that's right. But the loading and unloading has been interpreted to be, by some of these courts, an act which will create coverage in an insuring clause like this.
And then some of the cases also define loading and unloading as while it's in the vehicle as well, don't they?
Most of, I can't remember seeing any. Most of them are when you're moving the gun into or out of the vehicle. And in the Lindo case, if you recall, the gun was passed from one vehicle to another through the windows, and they still found no coverage. And the court in that case said, this is more analogous, in the last paragraph of the majority decision, said this is more analogous to that situation where somebody is just moving a gun inside the vehicle, which that is exactly what happened in this case.
Except,
somebody moved the rifle inside the vehicle.
Except we did use language in Lindo to say that it wasn't a hunting expedition.
Right, but I don't know that that is particularly important, because if you look back in the earlier other parts of the Lindo decision, they're talking about, excuse me, I might be able to find it. They're talking about The court can read it, and I don't want to spend my time looking for it in the decision, but I know what you're talking about, Your Honor, and I think that in the Lindo decision, they're talking about two things. It was a hunting expedition. It was not a hunting expedition. Plus, it was not a situation where they were moving. The court saw as being moving a firearm into and out of the car in the manner that created coverage under that. I think everybody on both sides can find something in that Lindo decision that makes them happy and they want to hang their hat on. I can and they can.
Is there a difference between Lindo and this one in that there's more of a connection with the vehicle because it's actually in there being transported for a hunting expedition, as opposed to Lindo where the gun wasn't really connected to the vehicle, the use of the vehicle necessarily. He was handing it through the window to show him, here, look it, I bought a new gun. Where this, the vehicle, there is a difference in why that gun is in the vehicle in this case, because they were actually using it and transporting it as part of a hunting expedition.
There's a difference as to why that rifle was in the Peterson car. That's true, but I think we're getting past the point of analysis here, and that is what the insuring clause says. And the insuring clause in the Lindo case was different. It wasn't an auto accident. It was the use, loading, unloading language. And even though in Lindo they clearly were loading or unloading the gun by passing it back and forth, they still found no coverage to exist. Now, that's why I think you can find a little bit to make everybody happy in the Lindo case. As the dissent in Lindo said, well, the majority said they can't find a case that's factually similar to this, so why are we looking at these other cases? Well, no, very few cases are identical, as you know better than anyone else. But I think the significant thing here is the insuring clause, the language of the insuring clause.
Talking about that, are you really asking this court to interpret it so narrowly that it only involves and that you are insuring under that insurance contract when two vehicles collide?
No, not at all. I think if you look at the various tests, and there's two of them that are set forth very succinctly that I cited in my brief. One was from Pegler, which was a South Carolina case. The other, which was Texas Farm Bureau versus Sturrock. That's the obvious case. You drive into a tree or you drive into somebody else in a car. But most of those cases also find that when, for example, there's the moving the gun off the gun rack, which was a fixed part of the vehicle, which caused the gun to explode. That was seen as a little bit different in creating coverage. No, I don't think we should ever advocate that we'd want to limit the term auto accident that extremely. On the other hand, I think that Washington court that looked at it and found that, well, there can be a lot of different things that constitute auto accidents, but the term itself is not ambiguous because most people are going to know what it means. I think that it's not to be narrowly construed or defined, but it is to be defined in a common sense manner that tells you that when they define the when they use that language to define the coverage grant, that it's got to be something more than the vehicle providing a site for the accident to happen. Now,
so it would involve some use of the vehicle.
I think the use of the vehicle has to contribute to the cause of the accident. Yes.
So since you haven't defined it, we will have to, in all probability, in the opinion, you just can't say it's like obscenity. I know it when I see it.
I think the court has to define it, not narrowly. I think that's why these terms, while I know that's why these terms are not defined in policies, and the court knows that. You can't define every potential circumstance, but you can look at some of those tests, and now might be a good time for me to talk about that. The two tests which I cite in my brief talk about the classic example, one vehicle hits another, the other one being used for exit and entry or loading and unloading of cargo, that sort of thing. I won't go through all the terms, but you're right. You do have to define it up to a certain point. That's correct.
But aren't we involved here with the use of the automobile and the extent that the gun is resting on the seat, apparently, and it's being moved because one of the people think it presents a dangerous situation or something, and then that causes the accident?
Correct.
So there's clearly the use of the vehicle in a sense that they perceived as dangerous.
Well, I don't think the person that moved it perceived the use of the vehicle contributed to its danger. I think the person that moved the gun when it discharged perceived the position of the gun to cause the danger. That's the distinction.
It's in connection, but it's, you know, it's in connection with the seat of the rear vehicle seat.
It was sitting on the seat, right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I think if you look at these other cases that talk about the situs of the accident versus a contributing cause on the part of the use of the vehicle, it has to be a vehicle being used as a motor vehicle that has a not insignificant contributing factor to the cause of the accident. And, you know, our position here would be that was not the case when this gun was moved. It wasn't the case. There's no evidence to indicate why the gun went off. We know it did. But there's no evidence to indicate that the use of the vehicle had anything more, if that, than an insignificant causal relationship to the occurrence of the accident.
Wasn't there something in the findings where the trial court actually entered some findings about the truck driving over the fields and rough country roads? Wasn't there something in there?
Yes.
Was that a finding, or was that?
I don't know if that's a finding or not. I can't remember. But if it was, there isn't anything beyond speculation. There is not one bit of evidence in the record anywhere to show how this gun was placed in a position to go off, how it was placed in a position to discharge. What appears to be uncontroverted is on Friday evening when they were done hunting, a neighbor drove up. He would not be an insured, by the way, for our policy. I don't know that that's significant here, but it may be. A neighbor drove up, opened the action of the gun, and left the lever sitting sort of perpendicular to the rifle and put it in the car. Well, the rifle was loaded. Nobody unloaded it.
Would there actually have been a shell in the barrel or in the chamber or whatever you'd call it?
Probably not, or it would have ejected when they did that.
Right.
But there would be a shell in the magazine, and if the lever was shut, that shell would go into the magazine. And the problem with these lever-action guns with exterior hammers is when that lever gets pulled shut, the hammer gets pulled back, and there's no safety on these guns, as in a traditional firearm where you push a button or slide something. The safety is if you have the lever open and don't depress it. There's a little pin under the lever in the stock. If you depress the lever, it depresses that pin, and anybody touching the trigger can make that gun go off.
Where is the magazine on that?
Magazine's a tubular magazine that parallel to the barrel. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's not when the lever is open, it can't fire, of course. The danger is when the lever is shut again, if the hammer is cocked, it can.
And 2 minutes.
Okay. I did want to talk about the facts, and that's where I got sidetracked, because I think if you look at the record, the facts that support the trial court, the findings entered by the trial court are not supported by the record. They're pure speculation. The truth is nobody knows how this gun got in a position to fire. Nobody knows if the vehicle contributed to that. Nobody knows if when the guy moved the gun, the lever was depressed, the shell went into the mag. This stuff can happen. Something happened here. Accidents often occur like this.
But isn't that why you have insurance coverage?
Yeah, it may be why you have general liability insurance coverage too, but Northstar's excluded coverage it would have otherwise granted, and as I say, I'm not here quarreling or disputing that, but I think the term auto accident is also something where you have to define what type of claims you're going to cover. And this with all due respect, was not an auto accident. If you look at the other authorities who have examined this, come up with the various tests in terms of causation and occurrence, they seem to be well-reasoned. And finally, the summary, which is contained in the Cameron decision, Cameron versus Ward, summarizes how these coverage decisions have gone in other jurisdictions and sites. Literally, there have been dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds of these kind of cases. And the first example they give is the accidental discharge of a gun inside a moving or motionless vehicle while an occupant of the vehicle is handling or toying with a gun. It says, without exception, no coverage exists in these cases because of lack of causal connection between the vehicle and the gun.
But this is not a statutory or common law cause of action. It's controlled by the language of your policy.
Right.
So what good is that?
This summary is summarizing cases, Your Honor, which interpret exactly that, interpret other insuring clauses, and in some cases exclusions, dealing with the very same situation. You're right.
And your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Schaefer, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Your Honor, my name is Mike Schaefer. I represent North Star Mutual Insurance Company. And we initiated this lawsuit, this declaratory judgment action. North Star issued two policies, a farm liability policy to Peterson Farms and an umbrella policy to Brad Peterson. Trial court found there was no coverage under either of those policies. There's no coverage under the umbrella policy because this auto was never listed on the declarations page, and the court's decision is exactly consistent with and the same as what this court held in North Star versus Rasmussen, a recent decision.
I'm not sure why you're here, though.
I am not either, because quite frankly, there's no claim by Milbank that the
you
court,
won your lawsuit and nobody's complaining.
And they haven't filed a notice of review, and
right.
I agree. Okay. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So your position is it doesn't get any better than this.
That's right. Mr. Anderson told me I couldn't lose this appeal.
What caused you to come?
Well, I guess I wrote a brief and I was listed on the argument calendar.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming. You win.
Well, Mr. Freeman, you have a little harder road to walk, I think. You have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Schaefer. I'm Rodney Freeman, and I represent, at least for the purposes of the declaratory judgment action, all of the Petersons. A couple of points that I'd like to clarify. Justice Meyer Henry asked, and I believe the question was whether or not he was asking this court to narrowly define auto accident, which is really, to me, the two terms of the two words that make up this whole issue, as a collision between two vehicles. I think that brings us to the heart of the entire problem. Milbank wrote the policy. They used the term auto accident. They didn't define that term. So instead, what this court's being asked to do, exactly as Judge Erickson at the trial court was asked to do, is to define that term for Milbank. Nobody knows what Milbank meant by that term, but we do know that terms that are undefined and ambiguous and not being defined, I would agree, doesn't automatically make something ambiguous. But in this case, clearly, this court is being asked to give Milbank and the Petersons and other insurers a definition. My question is, why shouldn't Milbank have provided that definition so that the Petersons knew going into that policy whether or not, if they are using that vehicle in a legal manner, which is a hunting trip, obviously you know you're going to carry rifles in a vehicle and wet clothing that gets thrown in the back seat and piled up on top of that.
Now, isn't that an issue, though? I mean, do you know that? Is that what you, how do you know that? How would you, we'd have to read that into that policy, that was an expected use of that vehicle. how can we do that?
Because they didn't exclude hunting. And they very easily, believe me, they have excluded an awful lot of things in not only this policy, but all insurance policies.
So if it's not excluded, it's in?
It certainly, I would consider it in if it's not excluded, especially when we don't have a definition of what they mean by what they're providing coverage for. So not only did they fail to exclude using the vehicle for hunting, but they fail to define what they mean by an auto accident.
It is a little hard, I mean, to tell someone, well, I was injured in an auto accident, I was shot. I mean, that doesn't sound like an auto accident, does it? I mean, that's a little bit, I understand what you're saying, but it is a little hard to fit it in with that term.
I don't necessarily disagree, but if Milbank wanted to exclude that, they could have defined what they meant by auto accident. The Supreme Court in Colorado dealt not with this exact same issue, but they dealt with a lack of a definition. And if I could, I would like to quote that court. And the case is Colorado Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Company versus West American Insurance Company, two insurers, declaratory judgment, trying to determine which one was to provide coverage. And the Supreme Court of Colorado said, auto accidents can happen in 1,000 different ways. If the insurer had desired to limit coverage to the types of accident where an actual collision or upset occurred, it could easily have done so. Not choosing so to do before this unfortunate episode, it cannot, as a matter of law, now so limit its liability. And that, to me, that is exactly what we're facing here. Milbank chose not to provide a definition of auto accident. Now, when one generally thinks of an automobile accident, certainly not the first thing that's going to come to my mind is that an accidental discharge of a rifle in a vehicle is not your typical auto accident of what most of us think of. But in rural South Dakota, and in many parts of the country, people routinely transport firearms in vehicle for hunting purposes. This was clearly a hunting expedition. I don't think there's any question about that. They hunted the day before. They hunted that morning. They went home to change their wet clothes, get a sandwich. They were going back out hunting that afternoon. Every bit of that's in the record. And I would also add that Jeb Peterson, the young cousin who actually moved the rifle and caused the discharge, was asked at trial, and this is part of Judge Erickson's findings of fact number 33, he was asked, is there any way that that rifle could have moved other than by jostling around in the vehicle during this hunt? And he said no.
But that's a disputed fact, isn't it?
No, ma'am. It was never disputed. It's not disputed by anyone.
It wasn't a stipulated fact.
No, ma'am. It wasn't a stipulated fact, but it was testified to. The transcript, I believe, is page 39, and then Judge Erickson specifically made that a finding of fact number 33.
So following up on that, is that one of the tests that we need to use, is whether or not the vehicle itself causes the gun or whatever it is that might be involved in the injury? Is a causal, do they have to show then that the vehicle's jostling itself caused it? Is that the test we should use?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. And the Allstate v. Powers case, which I believe is cited in all three of our briefs, specifically says, at the time of the injury, the vehicle was being used for the purpose for which it was designed, namely, to transport persons and objects, in this case, hunters and their weapons, exactly as here. Further, the injury was caused by the use of the vehicle to transport weapons. Therefore, this is not a case in which the vehicle was merely the situs of the accident. Rather, the injury occurred while the insured was using the vehicle for its intended purpose and arising out of that use. They don't say anywhere, I haven't found any case that says the vehicle has to cause the gun to discharge. The gun was in the vehicle on a hunting expedition, and I think that's contemplated under the policy.
How is it different than Lindo, then? Because Lindo involved a gun going off in a vehicle.
In that case, they were in the city limits of Huron. They were not hunting. They were simply two vehicles parked side by side in a parking lot at the Piggly Wiggly, and they were discussing future hunting trips. And one of them had a pistol and said he was showing it to him, and he passed it to the other vehicle. And when they gave it back, it discharged. They were not hunting. They weren't using the vehicle for a hunting expedition. I think the facts are so clearly distinguishable.
But if we affirm the judgment of Judge Erickson in this case, aren't we saying in a way that anything that happens between the loading and the unloading in a vehicle of guns or whatever, they're liable for under that policy?
Yes. And if Milbank doesn't like it, all they've got to do is define what they mean by automobile accident. I didn't create this, or the Petersons didn't create this fuzzy language. It was Milbank.
But isn't this something that maybe they should have personal liability insurance for rather than auto accident insurance for?
It's hard to answer that, Your Honor. But again, let's assume the rifle had been in the back window of the pickup on the gun rack, as we've all seen thousands of pickups in South Dakota carrying the gun. If that vehicle going through a field, or even going down the interstate and hits a hard pothole, and that gun flies out of the gun rack and hits the guy on the head, is that not an auto accident? How would that situation be any different from this one? Other than instead of hitting a bump and flying out and hitting the driver on the head,
well, in this case, the vehicle is running, but it's not moving. It's not hitting any bumps. It's not jarring anything loose.
But the rifle had been placed in the vehicle so that it could be, the rifle and the occupants could be transported first back to the house for overnight. It was left in the vehicle during that morning's hunt as they are driving over rough fields and rough roads, and they go home for lunch.
The vehicle had been loaded, and the vehicle had not yet been unloaded, so is the insurance company liable for all period of time that happens between the loading and the unloading?
I certainly think so. And if they don't want to be, they can exclude that.
Well, Mr. Freeman, that argument, though, would suggest that any time anyone doesn't define a term in an insurance policy or a contract, that it's got to be interpreted in favor of the other side. That's essentially what you're suggesting. And we always use common sense definitions, or we often say, what's the plain meaning? We often apply terms to apply meaning to undefined terms. Why shouldn't we do that in this case?
I think the court certainly can apply a common sense meaning to it. And to me, that would include that if you're using the vehicle in a manner contemplated under the policy, which is for hunting purposes and carrying loaded weapons and transporting the hunters. Again, we're supposed to, according to this court and every court, if a term of a policy should be coverage, should be interpreted broadly in favor of the insured. And so even without leaving out the lack of a definition, I think if you broadly interpret auto accident, which we're supposed to do, then certainly a hunting expedition would be included in that, which in my judgment would then include the transporting of loaded weapons. Now, I don't think hunters should transport loaded weapons, but that's not the issue here.
One other thing, this probably isn't terribly relevant, but where did this loading or unloading fighting a fact come from?
Excuse me, sir.
Where did Judge Erickson's loading or unloading finding of fact come from? And I ask you only because I didn't see any evidence of it. And a lot of the cases deal with loading or unloading. So if this is not one of those cases, it would be helpful to know that right away.
I think it might benefit the court to understand that when we first got involved in this lawsuit, we had Northstar had a policy. They also had an umbrella policy. We had Milbank with a policy. Everybody was using a shotgun approach. By the time we now stand before this court, we've narrowed it down to really basically this one issue.
So loading and unloading, in your view as well, is not an issue in the case, really?
Not at this point, no, sir.
2 minutes, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you. I don't need to continue droning on, so thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Anderson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. The position that if you don't narrowly define every term used in a coverage grant in a policy, that it means everything from the time you go out to your garage until the time you get home that happens in a vehicle is far, far more extreme, I think, than the position that I'm advocating here today. At least I hope that's the way the court sees it. I agree with Justice Meyer-Henry that it's not commonsensical to say that the only thing that constitutes a car accident is when you hit another car, when you run into the curb or hit a building. But there are a lot of things that don't constitute car accidents. I think we would all agree.
Are we bound by the term? You know, I want to know what you think of this statute, because are we bound just by the term auto accident in your policy, or do we have to look at SDCL 23570 that says that an owner's policy of liability insurance in South Dakota shall insure against loss from the liability imposed by law for damages arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of the vehicle? Do we have to use that language too?
I think you've got to consider it. I think there's case law that says statutes which govern insurance policies are, in effect, part of the policy.
Does that change your analysis
no.
then, use of vehicle as opposed to auto accident?
No, I don't think so, because the use, if you look at most of the cases cited in my brief, a number of them deal with the term auto accident after companies began utilizing that term in some of their coverage grants. But most of those cases say, well, use means loading and unloading, even if you don't say it. Loading and unloading means use. And regardless of what the coverage grant is, you have to find some causal connection between the use of the car as a motor vehicle, because you can use a car for a lot of other things that really, other than a motor vehicle, has to have that causal connection. So I think your point is that you have to consider the statute. It may well be something you have to consider, but I don't think it changes the analysis. I think that's right.
Most of those cases, though, when they've dealt with use, have found it to be ambiguous, which then gives the court then looked at it more favorably toward the insured.
Right, and that's the rule. That's correct. If it's I favor the Washington court that said the term auto accident is not ambiguous. Everybody knows what it means. Well, I don't know if everybody knows what it means in all circumstances, but I do think in many circumstances it's not ambiguous. It may depend on the setting. There are a lot of examples, however, if you use a broad, not the broadest, but even a broad definition of auto accident, and I cited some of them in my brief, that would be auto accidents, even though would never be intended as such, would never be contemplated by most people as such. I think Justice Sabers raised a good question with Mr. Freeman, that is, why shouldn't you have personal or general liability insurance to cover this? The truth is that of the hundreds of decisions from other jurisdictions that we've had concerning firearms and vehicles, it's generally has been a battle between the either farm policy or homeowner's policy and the auto policy to see who's going to pay for it. In this case, the Northstar policy is not a standard policy. It has a very unique exclusion here, excluding coverage that would have otherwise existed under the terms of that policy. So the answer is, in many cases, those are the policies that cover these claims. But it's a good question.
Can we use the what I'll call the homeowner's policy cases to help us interpret use?
Can we use homeowner's cases?
Homeowner's or general liability policy cases.
You mean Kate?
Can we or should we use those to help us define, in other words, if the case was decided under one of their policies with similar language?
No, I really think that there are enough auto policy cases that I think it's safer to confine it in terms of the Milbank coverage to other cases which are examining auto cases, right, if I follow your question.
Well, it might be safer, but why shouldn't we use... Why shouldn't we use homeowners or general liability policies if the language is similar?
I don't know. You mean if the coverage language in a homeowner's right. policy is similar to the Milbank policy here?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it would depend on the context. There may be times when you could use it if the situation required it or permitted it.
If we decide it's covered, is there still an issue on intervening cause?
That, if you look at the tests that I've set forth in my brief, and I've been remiss in not talking about this. Those tests talk about the motor vehicle contributing, but they also talk about an intervening or superseding or independent cause that breaks any connection between the vehicle and the incident or the injury. And that's a very good point. And even though it's a different situation, that Farm and City Insurance versus the State of Davis case that this court decided 6 or 7 years ago. It's not cited, I don't think, by any of us in our briefs. The site is 629 Northwest 2nd, 586.
Under our rules on police,
yes.
Just 12 copies to counsel.
I will, Your Honor. The issue was different. That was a drive-by shooting case. And they held that in that case, that was the fact that you drove the car, caught up with the guy, cornered the guy, and shot him out of the window didn't mean there's any coverage under the auto policy. Now, granted, that's a different situation than we have here, but the reasoning of the court recognized that this was one of those independent intervening superseding causes that would otherwise negate coverage that might exist. And these other cases have recognized that, so that's a good point.
But actually, that was not decided by the trial court in this case, was it? Was that issue raised?
I don't know that it was raised that way. I think it was raised in the briefs because raised it with
so,
the same cases.
I guess to follow up on that, does that issue become important in our decision on coverage, or is that still another issue that could be raised once, if we decide there is coverage, is that still another issue that can be raised again?
I think it's probably an issue that needs to be resolved now, and I think it's part and parcel of the authorities that have been cited by all the parties in their briefs. It comes up in most of those cases. That's right. Any other questions? Thank you,
Mr. Anderson. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Final reminder, if you wish to help yourselves to any of our publications on your way out the door, they're in the lobby. We're in recess.